Casey Freed Jennings, Lynn Scher, and Charles Gibson will be discussing the life and work of Peter Jennings on December 11th at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble at the Lincoln Triangle. And you can hear an interview that Leonard did with Peter Jennings in September of 2002 by going to the Leonard LoPage show page at WNYC.org, where there's a link. Up next, the history of Arabs and Jews in the ancient port city of Jaffa, and later a new play about three Palestinian brothers. Then stay tuned for Please Explain, find out what causes insomnia and whether there are any surefire cures for it. I hope there might be. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we're also heard on satellite.
WNYC is supported by the Guggenheim Museum, presenting Richard Prince, Spiritual America. The New York Times calls it a beautiful, seamless 30-year survey featuring the artist's series of cowboys, muscle cars, biker chicks, and Pulp Fiction. Tickets now available at Guggenheim.org. NYTimes.com Business, an online source for breaking business news. This week, the creator of the Google Phone, Andy Rubin, who Google is entrusting to take on Apple's iPhone. NYTimes.com, all the news that's fit to click. Con Edison, reminding area residents to call 811 before digging around their home or business. Utility companies will mark the area of underground facilities free. 811 to help ensure safety before digging. Con Edison, on it.
WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, contact Executive Director Vincent Gardino at 212-669-3013.
The Guggenheim Museum supports WNYC and is presenting Richard Prince, Spiritual America's Prince Photos. Prince's photos, paintings, and sculptures on view through January 9th. Information at Guggenheim.org. WNYC has two pairs of passes for the show, and we're giving them away now, starting with the first caller to reach us at 212-433-9692. Please note, if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days, you are not eligible for this set of passes. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard LoPate on this Friday afternoon. When historians write of the struggles in the Middle East or pretty much anywhere, what is often lost are the personal stories of the individuals and families who are trying to make the best of complex situations. Adam Labore has taken a different tack in writing his book City of Oranges, An Intimate History of Arabs and Jews in Jaffa. It's just been published in paperback by W.W. Norton and has brought Adam Labore back to the Leonard LoPate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Adam, you're the Central European correspondent for the Times of London and you live in Budapest. What drew you to Jaffa?
Looking back, I realize it's been about 30 years in the making from when I first went to live on a kibbutz before I went to university when I was 18 and a schoolboy. And I lived on a kibbutz called Ramat HaShofet, which was a very leftist kibbutz then in the north of Israel. And we worked in a factory. And every day I would see that the Arab day laborers would come in from the surrounding villages. And they were kind of part of the scene, but they were also separate. And I became very intrigued by them. And I've always been very interested in the lives of Arabs within Israel, which I think are much, you know, a very complex and a big question for Israel's future as well.
What drew you to a kibbutz at age 18?
Well, I grew up Jewish in North London and had a traditional kind of Jewish upbringing, and I wanted to go and explore some more of Israel for myself.
Now, I would assume, though, that at that moment, a curiosity about the Arab laborers was not something that was shared by many of your colleagues on the kibbutz.
I don't know if you'd say they were curious about them. They were just, it was different for me because I was coming in from the outside mm-hmm. and I could see that there was kind of two societies here. For them, it was an everyday reality that here is a kibbutz, supposed to be a socialist kibbutz, yet at the same time it's employing day laborers. So, you know, just on a very sort of idealistic, simple level, I asked, how can you have day laborers here, you know, wage slaves under capitalism, if you're supposed to be socialists? And why can't they join the kibbutz?
And what kind of answers did you get?
Well, we have to live in the real world and we have to make some money. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is they said they can't join the kibbutz because they're not Jewish, because they're Arabs.
And so this seed was planted in you. When did you go back to start following up on this?
Well, after that, I became more interested in the complexities of Israel. And so I decided to study Arabic. I did Arabic at university, Arabic in history and politics. And I did an Arabic degree at Leeds. And I also did a summer course at Hebrew University in Jerusalem in colloquial Palestinian Arabic, which was really useful because that's when we actually learnt to speak instead of just sort of learning medieval poetry.
When you started this book, did you think, all right, the way that I want to approach this is through the story of these families who go, some of them, way back in Jaffa history?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I wanted to do, is tell the human story of Israel and Palestine through the lives of the families. Because as you said in your introduction, that's the part that gets missed out. And I was listening to the station yesterday, and you were talking about the StoryCorps.
Yes.
And there was a woman on talking about how her brother died of AIDS. And I think this is what makes us connect as people, is to hear each other's stories and hear the narrative and drama of human life. Because what happens with Israel and Palestine, and with all conflict stories and with all news, is that you hear about suicide bombs, separation walls, wars, peace plans, Hezbollah, Hamas, Likud, Ehud Barak. I mean, what does that all mean to somebody who doesn't have the background? Not very much. But when you can trace the family, you can trace the Jewish family that lived in Jaffa since 1840 and helped found Tel Aviv. You can trace the Palestinian family that lived in Jaffa for just as long and fled in 1948, and then part of which came back years later to find that their old family home is now an Israeli old people's home. Then this brings it all alive. And that's what I wanted to do.
Those two families that you talk about, is that the Chalush family?
The Chalush families and the Hamamis. They are the two of the six families. I'd say they were the two main families, yeah.
You talk about Avraham Chalush, who was the sort of forefather of this group of people, as someone who epitomizes this story of the complexity of the relationships between Jews and Arabs in this land.
Yeah, I think what fascinated me about the Chalushes and about the whole of this book is uncovering sort of the threads of the narrative that haven't really been written about, at least in English language books. And one of those was the story of the families like the Chalushes, who came to Jaffa in the middle of the 19th century. They weren't political Zionists. They were what you'd call spiritual Zionists. They wanted to live in the Holy Land. But of course, as the national struggle evolved between Jews and Arabs, they chose sides, and they chose the Jewish side. But there was also many conflicts between them and the Ashkenazi Jews that came from Eastern Europe, because the Chalushes, they considered themselves part of the Middle East. They spoke Arabic. They were socially conservative.
Where had they come from?
They came from Algeria. And they came from Spain in 1492 in the expulsion.
After the expulsion.
And then went to North Africa. And they could get on absolutely well with their Arab neighbours and were very close friends with some of them. And they clashed with the Ashkenazi Jews because the Ashkenazi Jews had a very specific political agenda to build the modern Hebrew Jewish state. And that gave them a completely different perspective. And they were coming from persecution in Eastern Europe, and especially in the 20s and the 30s, with the rise of fascism and the Nazis. But I couldn't help feeling that the Chalushes might have offered, had the Sephardi families been given more of a role in this before the state was built, the history might have been slightly different, not, perhaps not so confrontational, which may be over-romanticizing it, but I still like to think it.
One of the things that, one of the threads that comes through in the book is this thread, not so much of religious identity, but cultural identity, and that the Chalushes, who were from Algeria, in a sense felt more comfortable with the way that life was led in old Jaffa, which was a very Middle Eastern, very Arab way of life. And then the more recent immigrants from Europe, there's a lovely even architectural contrast between what old Jaffa looks like and what Tel Aviv looks like. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, one thing which I found really fascinating in the book was about the role of architecture in the development of Israel and also in the clash between the two peoples. Now, I hadn't even realized when I started that Tel Aviv, or Neve Tzedek, which became the first suburb of Tel Aviv, was actually founded as a suburb of Jaffa. So the whole relationship between Tel Aviv and Jaffa is like a metaphor between Israel and Palestine. Tel Aviv started as a satellite of Jaffa, and then now has swallowed up Jaffa. So you see the broader political picture reflected in that. But the architecture in Tel Aviv is very fascinating, how Tel Aviv has one of the largest concentration of Bauhaus buildings in the world. And they built these Bauhaus, very simple, plain, but quite elegant blocks of flats, partly because they're cheap, they're made out of poured concrete, they're easy to make. But also it was a very political statement that here's Jaffa, tumble-down oriental houses, one on top of each other, narrow alleys, badly lit. I mean, inside the houses are beautiful, but, you know, the public space is quite chaotic. Whereas in Tel Aviv, it's nice and orderly. And, of course, you know, there was a strong influence from the German immigrants that were coming in, that everything had to be properly arranged. And it was a very strong statement that they want to be European in the middle of the Levant. And how you can do that is a tricky question.
Well, and that's, I just got this visual image of an interior versus an exterior life, that in Jaffa, the life happened within the walls of the houses. And in Tel Aviv, the life happened outside on the boulevards and in the cafes.
Yes, that's a very important point. In the Ottoman cities in the 19th and even up until the early 20th century, well, perhaps it had changed by the early 20th century, but there wasn't really very much the idea of public space, of open squares and cafes. No, life was lived inside. So an Ottoman city will look kind of chaotic and scrambled. But if you go through the door, you'll enter a beautiful courtyard with a fountain and lovely shade and good use of light. Now, that changed in Jaffa towards the end of the 19th century as the last sultan of the Ottoman Empire, Sultan Abdul Hamid, he wanted to modernise the Ottoman Empire. And, of course, there was always this thing that we want to show that the Jews don't have the monopoly on modernity, that we can be modern too. So you had the building in Jaffa of Clock Tower Square. It's like a big open piazza with shops. You had more modern markets built on a grid system rather than on a bazaar lane type system. And the clock tower itself was very symbolic because at the end of the 19th century, around the 1900, the Sultan built 100 clock towers across the Ottoman Empire. And what he's saying with these is that we no longer keep the day according to the call of prayer. We're going to have hours and minutes, and you're going to turn up for things on time, and we're going to be modern.
I'm speaking with Adam Labor. His book is called City of Oranges, An Intimate History of Jews and Arabs in Jaffa. My producer sent me a note that we're saying Jaffa, but it also can be Yafo and Jaffa. And how is the city called these days?
Well, in English we say Jaffa, and in Hebrew,
like the oranges.
Yes,
so,
yeah. Exactly. And in Hebrew we say Yafo, and in Arabic we say Jaffa.
Now, you follow this through the recollections, often in first person, of a variety of people who have lived in this area. We talked a little bit about Avraham Shalush. Can you talk a little bit about his relationships with the Arabs? And there's a lovely story about a young boy who he finds outside his shop.
Yes, there's an extraordinary story that runs as a thread through the book, which is that in the around 1870, Avraham Shalush, the patriarch of the family, finds a young boy in Jaffa crying in the street. And he asked the boy why he's crying. And he said because he bought a camel to sell at the market that his father sent him with from their home village in Tira in the north. But the camel had been stolen and all the boy's money had been stolen and he didn't know what to do. So Avraham Shalush gave him some money, a silver majid, I think it was, which would be the equivalent of several hundred dollars nowadays. And the boy and told him to go back home. And the boy couldn't believe it, but he accepted it and he said, how will I repay you? And he said, don't worry, you'll repay me one day. Then the story faded away for a few years until about 1917, at which point, as the First World War is drawing to a close and the Ottomans are losing, they turn on the Jews of Jaffa. This was almost a precursor to what happened with Armenia, and they deport them all. All the Jews are deported out of Tel Aviv and Jaffa into the countryside. And the economy collapses, there's nothing to eat, nobody has any money, and life is very difficult. And they get to a village, the Shalushes, and it turns out that the headman of the village is the boy who years ago Avraham Shalush had saved. And he saves the family. He gives them money, he gives them skins of olive oil and wheat and all the food that they need, and basically everything they need. And for years after that, the guy from the village is sending camel trains to Tel Aviv once a year, full of presents. And this carries on and carries on until the Arab revolt in the 1930s, when the fighting is really, really strong and the camel trains stop. And then in 1948, one of Avraham Shalush's descendants, a man called Aharon Shalush, is a governor in an area in a part of Israel called the Triangle. Now, the Triangle was a disputed area. It wasn't clear at first whether it was going to be in Israel or Jordan. And eventually it ended up in Israel, but the Israelis said only those who can stay can prove that they were born here. And so Aharon Shalush has this rather awful job of deciding who can stay and who can go. And then one day someone comes to see him and is begging and crying and asking to stay. And he looks at the guy's name, and it's the same name as the family that had saved his family in 1917. So he rings up Ben Gurion's office and says, "I've got this family here. Can they stay? You know, even though they don't fit the criteria, can they stay?" And Ben Gurion's office says, "Well, we don't really care what you do. You know, just get on with your job." So they let him stay.
That story so beautifully illustrated the way that lives were woven together, that it wasn't as separate as you saw when you were a young man, when the Arab day laborers came and then left, but you didn't know their stories, or as we imagine the world is, for the most part, today. What happened?
What happened? Politics, war, the usual stories. And there was an inevitable clash. You know, there was a clash going on between political Zionism, which wanted to build a Jewish state, and between Palestinian nationalism. And like all nationalist clashes, or like most of them, it was eventually settled by force of arms.
Did you find people who have retained that kind of intimacy, Jews and Arabs together, today in Jaffa, or is it more of a separate?
I think on one level it exists, the cooperation and the coexistence exists. I mean, it's a town with a mixed population of Jews and Muslims and Christians, and they work together and they live together. I mean, let's not over-sentimentalise it. They don't necessarily all love each other, but they do get on with things, and they live and work and fuel the economy and run restaurants and shops, and there are difficulties and there's some bitterness. But I still think that Jaffa could be a model for the rest of the Middle East if and when there's finally a peace plan that's meaningful, that here is a place where the three faiths do get on. And but that also brings a lot of problems in its way, because the people that the Jewish Israelis that go and live in Jaffa tend to be fairly well-off, liberal-oriented people. So they buy up the old Arab homes and restore them, which is nice, because that means that Tel Aviv municipality brings better municipal services into those areas. But at the same time, property prices rocket. And there's a big crime and unemployment problem in Jaffa. There's a massive drugs problem there. And one day, I spent a fascinating day, I went out on patrol with the police, and the guy told me that if Jewish and Arab politicians could cooperate like Jewish and Arab criminals do, we would have had peace by now.
There is another family that you follow that has as deep and intimate relationship with Jaffa as the Shalushes, and that is the Hamami family.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to them?
Yeah, the Hamami family were a middle-class Arab bourgeois family. The father, Ahmad Hamami, worked in the fruit and vegetable business. He had many Jewish trading partners. He used to lease orange groves from them, or they would lease them from him. He had about 9 children, and they lived in this beautiful old stone villa at the southern end of Jaffa in an area called Jebelia, which has now been renamed Givat Aliyah. And I became very friendly with Ahmad's son, Hassan Hamami, who now lives in Florida. And Hassan eventually wrote me his memoirs, a 40,000-word memoir, which is a very moving and powerful testament. And that I think that really brought home to me, with his memories of life in Jaffa before 1948, what a rich and complex society it was.
And then the exile after.
Yes, exactly. I think one thing that upsets Palestinians very much is when people say, "You weren't here," or, "If you were here, you were all living in tents because this place was just a desert." Well, Jaffa was not a desert. It had 3 newspapers, it had a radio station, it had cinemas and theatres, and it was the cultural and political capital of Palestine.
We just have a few moments. Is it one of his children who now lives back in Jaffa who is working with youth in the city?
Well, his granddaughter, Rima, is a lecturer now at Birzeit University in Jaffa. And his daughter, Fadwa, lives in East Jerusalem and often comes back to Jaffa. But there's just one thing I'd like to say, which made me very proud of my book, was that at the end of it, I held a party for all the families, all the Jewish and Arab families. And I felt a real responsibility, because I'm dealing with people's lives here in a book. It's not just a newspaper article that's going to come and go. It's going to live on, hopefully. And they all came to the party. So in this one party, you had a former member of the Stern Group, one of the most extreme Zionist militias, who had spent some time attacking and blowing up bits of Jaffa, in the same room as a Palestinian lecturer at Bir Zeit University, with the Shalushis, with other Jewish families, and all talking to each other. And I started to think, well, if we can do this here, at least that's a start.
That's a wonderful story and a wonderful way to end. Adam Labor, thank you so much for coming in to
thank
the
you.
Leonard Lopate Show today to talk about your book, City of Oranges, An Intimate History of Jews and Arabs in Jaffa. And Adam Labor is going to be speaking with Isaiah Sheffer as part of the Other Israel Film Festival tomorrow at 5 o'clock at Symphony Space. For more information and tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Adam, we have a minute left. It sounds like you found some hope in these conversations.
I did find some hope. I found some hope that people can connect as people, that somehow we have to sideline the politicians and the military leaders and just connect as human beings, and that can give us some hope.
Adam Labor, thank you so much again. Adam Labor is the author of City of Oranges, An Intimate History of Jews and Arabs in Jaffa.